Hello, and welcome to this, the fourth episode of Season 4 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I am Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
Last time, Graham, you said we'd be looking at the meaning of effectiveness in relation to financial crime. Can you say a little more about what you mean by that?
Well, Ray, we often talk about the effectiveness of anti-financial crime programmes. Indeed, the Financial Action Task Force, the FATF, seek to measure it at a jurisdictional level. But I often think we haven't really defined properly what we mean when we say measures are effective or ineffective.
It's a bit like talking about the performance of a car, isn't it? Everyone thinks of this in a different way, perhaps in terms of top speed or speed of acceleration or safety or economy or practicability.
Yeah, and unless you state explicitly what you mean by performance, in the case of a car, or effectiveness, you're likely to be talking at cross purposes.
So then, the big question is what we mean by effectiveness. But perhaps we can start with the big picture and think about all the things it might mean in the context of financial crime.
Good idea. Well, I think a decent starting point is to consider impact. If a measure doesn't have some kind of impact on something, then it simply can't be effective.
Yes, that's clear.
Then we can think about what different kinds of impact might arise from anti-financial crime measures. And here I think we can talk about three types of impact. I think there's human impact, there is economic impact, and there is reputational impact.
Okay, so human impact might be the fact that you're saving people from being victims of crime. Economic impact might be that you're reducing exposure of your firm to fines. Whereas reputational impact might be maintaining the good name of banking in your country.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
But even there are different perspectives, aren't there?
So how do you mean?
Well, let's take the last one. Reputational impact might refer to the reputation of a country or of a firm or of a specific business like wealth management or even to an individual office or person.
Yeah, it might. And an economic impact might again work at each of those levels or could be even wider. For instance, we know that illicit flows of money into the UK, and specifically London, have distorted the property market to the point where property ownership has moved out of the reach of whole sections of the community.
And then human impact could be for the victims of sex trafficking, for the people working in law enforcement, or those whose life savings are vulnerable to fraud at a local level.
Yes, absolutely. And for me, the reason why we need to understand what effectiveness means is that your view of effectiveness will govern the measures you take, which might well lead to very different outcomes indeed.
Graham, I can think of a great example of this that we've recently seen.
Oh?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the information sharing and collective work of some of the big Dutch banks that was recently announced.
Oh yeah. Now, for me, this marks a really big repositioning of the reputational impact. Here are firms who are quite clearly saying that not in my firm is no longer good enough, and that instead they need to adopt the not in my country approach.
Yes. If you base your measures on not in my firm, then simply avoiding certain risks yourself and moving the risk to other firms is an acceptable outcome. But if you move to not in my country, your outcome is to exclude financial criminals from operating in your entire territory, not just washing your own hands, your own bank's hands, of any complicity.
Yeah. And when you think of the societal impacts here, not in my firm actually has no net effect because the criminals can still operate, whereas not in my country has much more positive outcomes for society at large.
And meanwhile, there are lots and lots of people in individual firms doing really good work to thwart criminals who just move down the street.
Yeah.
But because all of the work is going on and all the paperwork is right there, is this an illusion of effectiveness?
Well, yes, and by some measures of effectiveness, I guess it's not illusory, because this is what the system values and this is what it produces as an outcome.
But it seems like a bit of a waste of effort, Graham, if those societal, those human impacts don't result too.
Well, I agree, and we both know the primary leverage which is being used on firms to achieve the right outcomes to be effective.
Well, yes. It's also topical, as we recently did a webinar with our friends at Finergo all about this, didn't we?
Yes, it was called Another Fine Mess.
And it was about fines.
Yeah, we need to talk about this fining regime and how it might skew those, albeit rather undefined, outcomes on which we judge effectiveness.
Yeah, we do. I mean, if a firm is facing a potentially swinging fine, it will almost certainly focus on avoiding the penalty or similar future penalties, rather than necessarily doing what we might think of as the right thing.
But not if the fines are directed at producing the right definition of effective, right?
Mm. Do all the various national regulators share a common understanding of effective, Graham? I mean, do they all pursue that shared effectiveness in the same way through their fining?
No, Ray.
Ah, right, OK. So let's just review the Finergo research and see what we can glean from it, and then look at how this might be driving behaviours and consequently outcomes.
Right. Where do you want to start?
Well, why don't we begin with the size and distribution of the fines?
I think that's a good idea. Now, I see from the research that the total amount of fines recorded since 2008 globally is $36 billion. Mm. Now, Ray, you love giving context to big numbers. So come on, give me some context for $36 billion.
Well, if you had them all in coins, Graham, it achieves some remarkable results.
I can't wait to hear this.
Well, let's start with weight. Each dollar coin weighs 8.1 grams. So $36 billion would weigh a staggering, literally staggering, 286,994 metric tons.
That's quite some weight, isn't it?
It's the weight of three fully laden Nimitz-class aircraft carriers, Graham.
Okay, what about height?
If you stack them all up, each dollar coin is exactly 2 millimetres thick, so $36 billion in coins would form a column 72,000 kilometres high.
Well, now, I happen to know that it's around 384,000 kilometres to the moon, because I did astronomy as a kid. So that is a fifth of the way to the moon.
Mm. It's even more impressive if, rather than stacking them up, you put them edge to edge, Graham. More than to the moon and back, if you'll excuse the rather niche literary reference. It's 24 times round the equator.
Blimey. What's your favourite analogy, Ray?
Well, OK, here we go. Let's imagine, Graham, that you could somehow transport all of these coins into a Las Vegas casino and you started feeding them into a machine at the rate of one per second.
Have you got a gambling problem here, Ray?
It's a thought experiment, Graham.
Oh, OK, sorry, carry on.
And let's further assume that you don't need to stop to sleep, eat or any other function, and furthermore, that the machine pays out nothing at all, which in my experience they don't.
Which underlines the fact you clearly haven't got a gambling
problem. Absolutely. No. Now, if you start doing this in March 2020, you would be stood there putting the last coin in the slot towards the end of December in the year 3160.
I don't think I'll still be around to do that, Ray, and I don't think you will either, honestly. And think about what inflation would have done to your money in the meantime.
Well, I think that's the least of your problems, Graham.
Yeah. They used to be called one-armed bandits, didn't they, those sort of things?
Yes, I'm sure that's how you remember them, Graham, from back in your youth when they were still in black and white. Yes. But that's not the end of the problem.
Oh?
There aren't actually that many US dollar coins in circulation. I've checked. There simply can't be enough to do the experiment in reality.
Oh, shame. But I think we have definitively confirmed that it is an awful lot of money.
Yes, I think so. So how does that split geographically?
Well, the report identifies the geographic split for the fines levied since the last report about 18 months ago.
And how much has been added in total in the last 18 months, Graham?
Around $10 billion, Ray.
Now that's a significant portion of the overall total.
It is, but as we'll see, it's been somewhat skewed by one enormous fine.
Okay, so let's come to that in a minute. Can we start with the US?
Yeah, they've issued a total of $4.3 billion since the last report, 86% of which relates to sanctions breaches.
Which is a big deal in the US.
Well, it is. And in contrast, in EMEA, Europe and the Middle East and Africa, they've issued $5.7 billion. But overwhelmingly, they relate to anti-money laundering failings.
But as we alluded to just now, $5.1 billion of that was a fine levied on one bank.
It was. Go on, tell me a bit more about that.
Well, I can't tell you too much. It was issued by the French against an unnamed Swiss bank, which was held to have assisted in the evasion by individuals of French taxes.
Now, this highlights for me one of the big ethical questions about the fines regime right now.
Surely there's no ethical question about censuring a bank for its role in tax evasion, Graham.
Certainly not, Ray. I don't have a problem with that at all.
So what's the ethical issue, Graham?
It's the cross-jurisdictional fining, Ray, and it's not necessarily an ethical issue, I suppose, as much as an observation that some jurisdictions levy much larger fines on those outside of their borders sometimes than those that are within.
I think I see where you're going, Graham. Fines are actually quite big now. They have to be, because otherwise there's a risk that firms might just price them into their models. And governments are obviously protective of their own fragile economies.
Yeah, so that when they can collect a fine from outside their borders, it doesn't risk the stability of their own system, while at the same time having an appreciable positive effect on their balance of payments, there might be a temptation to be more severe than they feel they can be internally.
And of course, it's only what we used to call the developed economies that can really get away with that.
Yeah, and we're not having a go at France here, not particularly. We haven't looked at any equivalent fine they've issued internally and found it to be much smaller. It's just a really big fine, and we see from the record that particularly big fines tend to be levied on firms in a different jurisdiction from the fining authority.
Yes, so we've got mostly sanctions fines being levied by America, which, given the US dollar's role in international finance, isn't perhaps surprising. Whereas in Europe, the Middle East and Africa, it's mostly about money laundering. What about Asia, Graham?
Well, Ray, the first thing to note is that the Asia-Pacific region accounts for a tiny, tiny, tiny proportion of the total. It's not billions, it's just a few millions.
But focused on money laundering.
Indeed.
And it will be interesting to see whether the current profusion of money laundering investigations at banks in Australia will end up in a big pile of fines, or whether there will be a different approach there.
So what are the different approaches that could be taken, Ray?
Well, one is increasing use of personal accountability regimes.
Where the senior management of the bank face personal action for the failings of their bank?
That's right, Graham. That action might be a personal fine, a ban from holding similar office in future, or even imprisonment.
And why might that be more effective? We still haven't defined that word, mind you, but let's carry on. Then fining the bank millions or billions?
Well, let me ask you this, Graham. When a bank gets hit with a fine, who pays it?
The bank pays it.
And who does that money end up coming from?
Oh, I see what you mean. I mean, it can only come from one of two sets of people, which is either shareholders or customers.
Yes, shareholders pay through reduced dividends, and they might separately be hit with a slip in the share price following a fine, and customers will pay through increased bank charges.
So that raises two points, doesn't it? How far is that likely to persuade management to ensure different behaviour when the sanction doesn't hit them personally?
Yeah, that's a good question. The second?
Well, it's that the people who end up paying the fine are broadly the same people who would have been victims of the original crime.
You might need to expand on that, Graham.
All right, so let's think about an ordinary family. Perhaps they're getting on in age, retired, and they've fallen victim to a fraud that's robbed them of their life savings. The fraudsters have laundered the money through a bank that's now been fined for money laundering failings, and that bank, in response to the fine, puts up its charges a bit or shaves a fraction of its savings account interest rates, hitting our family in the pocket a second time. First the fraud itself, and now the cost of the bank fine.
I see. Looking at it in a larger sense, it's society that's taking a double hit, both from crime and from the financial penalty for the crime. Society's losing out twice.
Yeah, and the banks press on, soon recovering from any short-term dip in their profits.
But surely the impact of fines is more a reputational one, isn't it?
Well, yes, it should be, and it still can be, but come on, Ray, tell me, have you ever heard of compassion fatigue?
I have, but perhaps you'd explain it for listeners who might not have.
Well, I will. On the one hand, it can describe a serious psychological condition, but in common usage, it describes what happens when people are exposed to a great deal of media focusing on suffering and tragedy. In small occasional doses, that produces a compassion response from the viewer or the reader. But if they're exposed to more and more day after day, they become desensitized and their compassion muscles, if you like, get overworked and stop functioning.
So you'd argue something similar is happening with reputational hits?
I am. I think reputational harm works best when fines are unusual and stand out. When perhaps 20% of all the banks in the country are fined in 1 year, it becomes background noise. Soon the only kind of fine that gets any attention is a massive one.
And that's soon forgotten when an even more massive one comes along soon after.
Yeah, exactly. And if your goal in fining is to cause reputational impact, you're going to have to accept fine inflation if you want that to keep working. And that can't last forever.
And so we're back to effectiveness again. Is an effective regime one that punishes banks and other firms, or one that focuses instead on societal harm and seeks to minimise that?
Well, to be fair, that's what all regulators are trying to do. It's why they exist, to protect society. The fining regime and their other powers are the means by which they seek to achieve it.
But as we've seen, it isn't necessarily producing that outcome, and unless it does, can we really call that effective?
It's food for thought, Ray, and here's just a little bit more. What happens to the money raised from fines?
Do you know, that's not something I've heard being talked about.
No, but if you think about it, it's important. That money could just fall into general government funds, or it could be used to pay the costs of the regulator.
Or it could be used in some way that seeks to compensate the victims of crime.
Yes, it could. Of course, with money laundering, the victims of the crime are not likely to be easily identifiable, are they?
But does that mean there shouldn't be an effort? Right now, the investigation ends with the proof of the money laundering crime. Law enforcement might be able to follow up on the criminals themselves, but that's a separate initiative. And if anything comes of it, it's rare to see recompense for the actual victims.
And that's true. But it would be easy to benefit the types of people who have suffered. For instance, if you know the money laundering resulted from corruption in a particular place, any fine could be paid to aid organisations in that country.
I like the idea of that, Graham. Does it happen?
Well, I haven't seen it done quite like that, Ray, although there are regimes where you'll see thought going into what happens to the fine money. In the US, for instance, there is a specific fund for the victims of crime that some of the fine money ends up in. Unfortunately, very little of it gets paid to victims, who get a better deal directly through the courts, so most of the money ends up absorbed into the Justice Department costs.
And in the UK, you often hear about projects designed to use fine income creatively, but much of it covers the costs of the investigation.
So once again, the benefit for society is quite widely distributed and not directly related to the crime itself.
Well, that's true. I think that's pretty much all we have to say about fines and their effectiveness, except to note that we really need a broader conversation about what effective means.
Yes, we do. And next time, perhaps we could look at a particular way we are going to try and achieve that.
Are you talking about the Dark Money Conference, Graham?
Yes, I am, Ray. And in case you missed the news out there, we are hosting a conference in London in September to look closely at this and related issues.
We are. We want to get all the good guys in one place. That means banks and other firms, AML consultancies, RegTech providers, but also regulators, law enforcement and investigative journalists.
Yes, which is exciting. And there's a link on our site for those who want to register interest at this stage. Let's talk more next time about what we're hoping to achieve.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dark Money Files. We hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to listen to future episodes, please subscribe through iTunes, Spotify, or your normal podcast provider. Thanks.